a sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 29, 1992, in the series Following Jesus, entitled, I Don't Know How to Love Him. The scripture readings are Luke 8, verses 1 through 3, and Matthew 27, verses 50 through 61. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Our worship theme this Lenten season is following Jesus. And to follow Jesus, it is necessary to know something of the shape of Jesus' life, the manner of his behavior, his spirit, his attitude. And so this was recognized early on, and there were four Gospels that were written, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And for centuries, the church read those Gospels as though they were accounts of the life of Jesus that could be taken quite literally, just as they were presented. And as those Gospels were compared one with another, there was a recognition that the chronology was rather difficult to put together, and that there seemed to be different emphases and so forth. But nonetheless, there was assurance that these were pictures of the life of Jesus, and one could read them and know something of the historical Jesus. When I was at Hope College, I think I even had to purchase a Harmony of the Gospels. Do they still sell that book? I hope not, really. I have in my hand a book published in 1969 called The Life of Christ in Stereo. And there was a gentleman who had studied for the ministry and then was wise enough to cop out the last moment, but he did have good tools of Greek and Hebrew. And then in the midst of his life, he was stricken with a disease that put him to bed. And there he was. And so he spent his time snipping the Gospels. I can imagine a whole pile of old Bibles that he might have had, you know, and he could clip this paragraph from Matthew and then slip one in from Luke and then add one from John and go back and pick up Mark. And so you could read from the beginning to the end. And here it is. The whole of the four Gospels put into one consecutive tale and narrative. Isn't that wonderful? Not really. Because it not only does not give us one gospel, it distorts all four. Because the four gospels were written by four different evangelists to four different congregations, four different concrete communities with four different sets of needs for four different purposes. Now, they weren't written for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years after the event. So they had all of the oral tradition of the early Christian community. And they had all of the experience of being Christian to work with. And so they had material from which to select. And that's what they did in order to do a specific thing, in order to make a certain point. John tells us that very clearly in his gospel. In the 20th chapter and the 30th verse, he says, there were indeed many other signs that Jesus performed in the presence of his disciples which are not recorded in this book. In other words, I have done a little selecting here, folks. I haven't given you the whole picture. This isn't a snapshot. This is a portrait I have painted. Why? These things are written. My selection was in order that you might believe that Jesus, the one that lived, that very real human being who, when he ate garlic, you smelled his breath. That very real Jesus who, when he walked on the earth, got his feet dusty like anybody else. That you might believe that that one was the Christ of God, and believing, have life through his name. Now, it's very interesting. You know what's above in the paragraph above? Story of Thomas, that disciple that Jesus found in Missouri. The one who said, Dead people don't rise, fellas, unless I can the nail prints. I'll not believe. Jesus appears. And Thomas says, "My God." And Jesus said, "That's right." Jesus said, "Happy are those who never saw me and yet believe." Because that was the problem for John in his day, in his community. Those who never had the chance to rub elbows with that one whom his contemporaries knew was as real and true and flesh and blood as they were. So, now here we are. And we've got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So now we've got the historical records, right? Wrong. We've got faith documents. We've got history seen through Pentecost, through Easter, through Good Friday. And the day-by-day life of Jesus as it was experienced by his contemporaries is very difficult to recover. Their problem was not that Jesus was truly human. The gospel writers, in the experience of Easter and Pentecost, in the experience of the Christian community, said, as Thomas said, "This Jesus, my God." They had to say, "This one was that one." But all we have are documents that say that one was this one. And so we've got a kind of supernatural, divine Savior who started there and dipped down here and did his thing and went back there. We've got this exalted Christ for whom it is very difficult to get next to in terms of a human Jesus who might have been flesh and blood like us, who might have cared about this world, who might have had something to say about those who would follow him. Oh, it's a lot easier. Just let him be Son of God who comes down, dies for our sin, and goes back. I'm off the hook. My sins are forgiven. But what we've done to Jesus is reduce his life to a comma, as in the Apostles' Creed. Born of the Virgin Mary, comma, suffered under Pontius Pilate. Let's leap from the virgin birth to the atoning death and not get all nervous about that concrete life of the one who said, "I give you an example, follow in my steps." Well, there is good news, because today there seems to be a new interest in the life of Jesus. There are all kinds of historical methods whereby the layers can be peeled off. And this research is going on all the time, and some very interesting studies today that would peel off that faith crust in the Son of God in order to lay bare the flesh of the man from Nazareth. Wouldn't it be interesting if we could just get out of time for a bit and have someone who actually followed him tell us what it meant? I think I see such a one coming.
My name is Mary Magdalene, which means simply Mary of Magdala. Magdala was the village where I was born and raised. My memories of Magdala are not particularly good ones, because I spent most of my life there filled with what we called evil spirits. I had heard of Jesus even before I first encountered him. He was healing and teaching around Capernaum near the Sea of Galilee, which is not too far from Magdala. His first disciples were from that place. Peter and his brother Andrew, the Zebedees, James and John, they were fishermen. But you probably know all that already, don't you? Because you have a great gift, the written word and the ability to read it. Most of us had only the words we could hear with our own ears and the sights that we could see with our own eyes. You see a whole picture, don't you? But for those of us who were in the midst of it, it was not at all clear at times. And yet, we knew the man. We walked with him and we talked with him. We touched him. And we held his hand. We experienced the power of his spirit, of God's spirit in him. So perhaps ours is the greater gift, or at least as great a gift, for I fear that perhaps your written words, he is beginning to become imprisoned behind them. Words, you know, words are such inadequate vessels, and they can grow rigid and cold with time. That's why I've come, you see, to breathe some fire and life into those words, to bring you his human passion and love. I owe him at least that, because he gave me life when he banished the demons and filled my soul with truth strong enough to keep the evil spirits at bay. But how to do that? I thought perhaps if I remembered things about him that have stayed with me, what were my strongest impressions of him? 3 short years is all his ministry was, you know, and I knew him for less than that, really. But the intensity of the experience, it changed lives. It changed my life. I have seen your artist renditions of Jesus, and I think you misunderstand. He is so often meek and mild. If you think that it was easy to be around Jesus of Nazareth, you are mistaken. He was a relentless seeker and prophet of truth. He was always asking why. And why not? He was challenging rules and laws that had become burdens for us. It wasn't enough for Jesus, for someone to answer, "But it's always been done that way," to claim tradition. Or even simply to say, "The law requires it." Or Jesus believed that they had lost sight of the purpose of the law and the purpose of tradition. "Why don't you wash before you eat? It is written in the law," they said to him, "because it's what comes out of one's mouth and one's heart that determines whether or not we are clean," he said. "Why do you eat with tax collectors and sinners?" the Pharisees asked him. "Does a physician come to one who is well?" he asked. And they were appalled at the way he kept, or didn't keep the Sabbath. They say the Pharisees invited him to dinner on the Sabbath once. When Jesus arrived, all the seats of honor were taken, the ones closest to the host. So obviously they had not invited him because of their great love and respect for him. Jesus said when he entered the room, he could feel their eyes watching him. And then almost immediately there was a knock at the door. And then it was clear. The invitation was a setup. For in the doorway stood a lame man. And it was the Sabbath, and of course, it was unlawful to heal on the Sabbath. They say Jesus looked at the man and then turned and gazed at those seated around the table, pious and faithful keepers of the law, each of them. And he asked, "If your cow fell into a well on the Sabbath, would you pull it out to save its life?" And the question hung in the air. They didn't need to answer. They knew they would. And so he turned. In strong truth, he turned and healed the man on the Sabbath. For Jesus said, "The Sabbath is made for us. We are not made for the Sabbath. It is God's gift to us for well-being. So what better way to keep Sabbath than to heal the broken and the lame and the healing?" Have you ever known someone in your own life who, when they were near, it seemed somehow as if God were close? I mean, when you are with them, you believe in God and in yourself, in life, and in a future. It was that way with him. The power of his presence. There are not words that can describe it. Only happening in his presence. People were healed. By his touch, they were healed. They were made whole by his compassionate gaze. How? I don't know exactly. I only know that it happened. I saw a woman. She had had a flow of blood for 12 years, and no one had been able to heal it. She managed to just reach out and touch the fringe of Jesus' garment, and she was healed. The crowd was large that day, and I'm sure she hoped no one would notice. I mean, it was a great risk she took, you know. It was unlawful for her to touch the Master's garment in that condition. With her flow of blood, she was unclean. And so untouchable. But can you imagine? Untouchable for 12 years. She must have been desperate. She risked and she reached out, praying that something would happen, hoping that she would not be noticed. But she was. He noticed. Immediately, he turned and said, "Someone has touched me. I felt power going out from me." Then she came forward, terrified, trembling. She fell at his feet, weeping, and told him why she had touched him and told him that she had been healed. You should have seen him then. He lifted her so gently up until she was standing right next to him. And then he gazed unflinchingly in her eyes and said, "Daughter, go in peace. Your faith has made you whole." Word would spread when someone had found healing. The people would come bringing others who had needs. And then the crowds would swell even greater. But you need to know something. He never used his ability to heal or to discern where people were hurting to manipulate them. He never used their adulation to claim political power and authority. How often didn't he heal and say to the one made whole, "Go and tell no one"? He didn't heal to draw attention to himself. He healed to draw attention to God through him and to the way to God. You know, I don't think Jesus even intended that there should be a religion called Christianity. Oh, I think it was essential for the Gentiles and for the persecuted ones in the years that followed. But Jesus was a Jew. In that time of his ministry, I think what he longed for most was that the Pharisees and others like him would see the error of their ways, see that they were becoming an obstacle, a block to our way to God. What else? Perhaps this, his attentiveness to the overlooked, the disregarded, the shunned of humanity. It never ceased to amaze me or to delight me. His availability to lepers, to tax collectors, to sinners, to children, to women. I don't know if you can understand, but there are times when men look at women. When they look at us, it seems that they're not seeing us, they're not touching us, but they're seeing objects to own or to use. It was not like that with Jesus. I wish you could have seen the way he looked at me when he banished the demon. I've thought about that moment often. And I've come to believe that he healed me with a look that accepted me just as I was, demons and all. He cast them out when he touched me, not with a touch of lust, but with a touch that showed he valued me. And for me, that is still the greatest miracle. So, I tell you what I remember of him. The Jesus who for us was so real, so human, so down to earth, and who for you, I fear, is becoming so exalted, so majestic, maybe even so unbelievable. Let me say it again in another way. I know that Jesus was a man because his humanness caused for me a particular dilemma, and I am not afraid or ashamed to tell you. I was in love with him. Why do you think I dragged myself to the foot of that cross? 1,000 soldiers could have not pulled me away until I had seen him breathe his last. Why do you think I went Sunday morning in hopes that I might see him one last time? But I didn't know how to love him. He moved me so, and I longed to love him in the only way I knew. I longed to cling to him in the way one would, to keep him with me. And yet I couldn't. I had to let go because I sensed that he was called for something more, chosen for something more. Maybe he was even born for something more. I don't know. But I think you have a dilemma too. The gospel writers And the apostles that preached Jesus, they took for granted that he was a man. And so they talked about that other something that we felt when we were with him. The way in which he was so filled full of God that there was a unique relationship there. And now, centuries later, you have read only of that. Are you able to cut through the doctrines and the creeds about him? Cut through the black and white translations and the spoken pious cliches to feel the heart and the soul and the way and the truth of the man? Or do you cling too tightly to his godliness? So, I have a dilemma, and you have a dilemma. On the one hand, his humanness that I knew, his fire and his passion. On the other, his godliness and his glory. Perhaps that's why the church has so long confessed Jesus as truly God and truly man, to honor us both. But I wonder, if I may say so, I wonder if perhaps my perception of him is less confusing, does not distort things as much. You see, what I remember most is that he wanted to show us the way to God and the way to the kingdom of God. In loving him, his human person, I saw the face of God. And to my deep delight and joy, I have discovered that now to love another person, even though I can't reach out and touch him, when I love another person, it is though he is with me. And now I find that in them, I see also the face of God. I experience that one who dwells in love dwells in God. Loving one another, it is the way to God. It is the only way I know to follow Jesus.